20 years of schooling and they put you on the day shift. That was famously written as a cynical indictment of society, specifically a cynical indictment of work. You know, the idea that this golden prize that you've been working towards, this golden prize waiting for you at the end of your childhood, at the end of your education, well, guess what, kid? It ain't all that. But read that today, and that cynicism now seems more like a wishful fantasy. You know, today it would be 20 years of schooling, and now you can compete for an unpaid internship. 20 years of schooling, and get an e-bike to deliver ramen. 20 years of schooling, but maybe also get a side hustle. Or you know what? Like, maybe forget the 20 years of schooling. I honestly don't know if I should be telling my own kids the classic story that they have jobs as kids, and that job is to do well in school so that they can later get into a good college or university so that they can then get good jobs. It's very confusing. I do not know what to make of the state of work in Canada. I'll give you three quick examples of what I'm talking about here. One, we keep reading about this massive labor shortage. Companies can't find workers to fill all the open jobs. But then the newspaper tells me that Canada lost 300,000 jobs since July. And there has been a huge jump in the number of people collecting unemployment in Ontario alone. So which is it? Are there too many jobs to fill and not enough workers, or too many workers and not enough jobs? I don't know. Example two. I keep reading that things are looking up. Canada's labor market added tens of thousands of new jobs last month alone. But the same story told me that our national unemployment rate went up in that same time period. So again, what is that about? Which is it? One last example. Example three. What's going on with the labor movement? I keep hearing about how unions are back. The labor movement is resurgent. It's reinvigorated. It's sweeping new industries. Gig workers are getting unionized. Starbucks workers, Amazon workers. We've told these stories. And then I look at the long-term stats and I don't know, it's the same old, same old. The overall percentage of unionized workers in the private sector is lower than ever. So what is going on here? It's like we don't even tell stories about work anymore. We just have stats. And the stats contradict each other and they confuse more than they clarify. It did not used to be this way. Labor used to be a beat, a major beat for any newspaper, which, you know, makes sense because what happens with work, with the world of work, that matters to so many more people than like any other vertical or section in the newspaper, more than politics or foreign affairs or even business. But the age of the working person's newspaper is just about dead. And along with it, the labor beat. Even the Toronto Star, the last of the classic city dailies, you know, a newspaper targeted towards middle-class families, the working people. Even they have decided to call their labor reporter, who happens to be really good and maybe one of the last full-time labor reporters in the country, but they're not called a labor reporter. The Toronto Star calls them the work and wealth reporter. Somehow the whole topic of labor is considered old school. At least to editors, but maybe not to news audiences. We get constant emails from you asking us to take a closer look at work in Canada, especially now, because this is a way bigger story than you can just tell with stats. But what is that story? I mean, if we did decide to dedicate resources to finding the real stories about work, what would we discover? Well, we're about to find out. The entire new season of our sister show, Commons, is called Work. And I'm going to hand the job of hosting this show over to the Commons team in a minute. And they are going to tell you about what they have found. And you're going to hear some of it for the first time anywhere. Wait for it.
Get your ass up and work.
Workers don't get a lot of respect these days. We're too lazy, too unproductive, too entitled. But the reality is that over the last decade, it's been a pretty shitty time to be a worker. I'm Archie Mann, and on this season of Commons, we're going to dissect the fascinating history and ever-changing present of what it means to be a worker in Canada. From the rise of gig work and temp agencies that have turned job security into a joke, to giant corporations wringing out every ounce of profit by exploiting temporary foreign workers and international students, to the relentless attacks against all of our wages, benefits, and even basic working conditions. We'll be going deep into the trenches of the ongoing war on workers. We'll ask the question, who and what is to blame? And we'll show you the many, many ways that workers have banded together to fight back. Follow Commons wherever you get your podcasts.
There is nothing wrong with your podcast feed. Do not attempt to adjust the program. We are controlling the transmission. We being the team behind Candleland's award-winning documentary show, Commons. This is a Commons takeover of Candleland. Commons is launching a brand new season. It's coming out on Wednesday. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Jordan Cornish. I'm the longtime producer of Commons. And the worst job I ever had was as a hostess at a bar. Because what's a delicate way of putting wear a tight t-shirt was the job?
I think you just did it.
I did not like it for that reason. And I'm sitting down here with my two colleagues.
My name is Noor Azriyeh, and the worst job I ever had was working at a Lebanese convenience store where I was asked at 9 p.m. to go wash the windows, whatever the hell that means.
My name is Archie Mann. I worked a lot of weird jobs, including data entry, taxi dispatch, nail polish factory, but by far and away the worst job I ever had was Tim Hortons. Because it is horrible to have to serve people coffee who are addicted to caffeine before they've had their coffee. They are mean to you.
I think as good a place to start as any is to introduce Commons as a show. So Archie, why don't you just start by telling all these fine listeners on the Candleland feed how we think about our approach to journalism before we get into talking about everything that's messed up about Canada and labor.
We've had 12 different seasons of Commons, this being the 13th, covering all kinds of things from corruption to the oil industry to the dynasties that run Canada, the war in Afghanistan, policing, so many different kinds of things. And often labor and work come up in those seasons. I think a lot of people nowadays, when they think of labor reporting, a lot of it has to do with kind of white-collar workplaces because there's been a lot of change there. But I think the majority of our season, we're going to be focusing on pretty kind of blue-collar, a lot of it resource-based kind of stories. So whether that's the fishery, whether that's farming, but also some things that you might not expect. I mean, Jordan, you've been working on some stories about prison labor, which I think is not something that we usually associate, say, with like labor reporting or, you know, the union movement or anything like that, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think about when it comes to that sort is I feel like Canadians know more about the American prison system than we know about the Canadian system. People remember that big AP story that came out really recently, making connections akin to slavery when we talk about prison labor in the United States. And we have a very different relationship with labor and in our prisons in Canada, and I'm really looking forward to putting those episodes out there and talking about some of the differences, because there's so many connections between things like the fisheries, things like migrant farm labor, and our prison labor system that I think will shock people when they hear it. Noor, what's something you're excited to work on this season? Something you're looking forward to?
Because I'm not ancient and prehistoric like my co-producers Archie and Jordan, I'm really excited on tackling is the video game industry, because I'm a video game guy.
Okay, I really feel like I caught a stray there.
No.
Us at our big ages have never played video games before.
I was playing video games before you were born, Noor.
That's not something to be proud of.
It's literally true and also describes how old I am. Yes. One thing, Noor, you've talked to us a little bit about is that you're from Qatar, mm-hmm. a country where, like, labor is very different. I mean, how has being in Canada kind of changed your relationship to thinking about work, thinking about labor?
Honestly, in doing the work on this season, I've been quite surprised at the damning similarities between the labor market and just like labor relations in Qatar as they like exist here in Canada. It's quite scary to think about that.
It is weird if you think about it as similar, right? Because even in my head, I think about it as so different, right? To have this almost servile migrant underclass that does everything for you, like you see in a lot of countries in the Gulf, right? Whether it's Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia.
Totally.
And it's dispiriting to me to hear you say that this reporting that we've been doing has been leading you to think that actually Qatar and Canada might have more in common than we think.
Yeah, and Jordan and I were actually at a press conference this morning that was focusing on migrant care workers, and I was sitting there genuinely mouth wide open, shocked at the stories that I was hearing, because those are stories that I hear from when I was living in Qatar as well. And to think of just like how Canada likes to pretend it's so much better than everywhere in the world, and especially when it comes to like immigration and labor, it was scary to hear those women talking about their experiences and thinking about the experiences of women that I've heard in the Gulf, in the Middle East. It's unbelievably similar.
You know, one thing that makes this season, I think, different is like, okay, say we did a season on mining. Well, none of us are miners, right? Yep. We did a season on the war in Afghanistan. None of us are soldiers. None of us are Afghans. But we are all workers. And I think that relationship to it is quite different. You know, just a few weeks ago, my mom called me. She's a cleaner. And she, for a long time, was working through a temp agency at basically a factory in order to clean it. The temp agency basically legally was taking like 30% of her wages. And like that shit pissed me off to no end. You know, I find it hard to have like kind of distance from stories of labor exploitation like that because it's happened to my family. I feel like it's happened to me as well. You know, journalism, this isn't a very pretty industry these days.
Yeah. No.
I don't know, Archie. I don't know if listeners of Canada Land know, but journalism's in a little bit of a state of crisis right now. But even some of my early experiences in this industry really taught me about, like, how bad being a worker can be, you know. My first job at a major publication, I had my pay cut twice in 4 months. My second job, they basically like paid me illegally as a freelancer. And so I was getting way less money than I was supposed to. I got it like 6 weeks late, which led me to be briefly homeless and sleeping on friends' couches and things like that. And those were like my first two major jobs in the industry. And I feel like when I look back at them, I don't think about the lessons, journalistic lessons I learned or like the reporting experience. I think about my labor exploitation, right? Like how they took advantage of me. And that's a pretty shitty thing, right? But I think a lot of our listeners, I think a lot of us in this room probably have had very similar kinds of experiences. I mean, Noor, the only way you're able to stay in this country right now is based on this job right here. Do I have that right?
I have to be working, correct. I'm lucky enough that I don't have to work specifically at Canada Land. That's like a rarity for most people, but I have an open work permit. I could work anywhere, but I have to be working. And when that work permit's over, I'm booted out. That is it. And I've been living here for 6 years. It just seems like the only value I have and the only value I bring to this country is the work that I do. Again, really reminds me like when we were at that press conference and that woman was talking about how, you know, just years prior she could have become a permanent resident and now she's just like undocumented, working under really precarious working conditions. But it just goes to show that when the government needs you, dying to have workers, they'll completely overhaul the immigration system overnight. And then when they're done and everything's back to normal, the pandemic's over, you know, they just shut it down
You know, I think this was a major lesson that a lot of people learned during the pandemic, is that our identities, first and foremost to the Canadian government, is as worker. You know, we were kind of lucky because we work in a white-collar profession. We could work from home. We didn't have to necessarily come in. But for the majority of Canadians, or at least for a vast number of Canadians, that simply wasn't true. They had to go into work, risking their lives, into all kinds of environments. And, you know, for a brief moment, we kind of applauded essential workers. You know, we weren't allowed to see our families. We weren't allowed to see our friends. We weren't allowed to socialize or do all kinds of things. But the thing that we had to do was go to work. And that makes it very explicit how I think society, the economy, the government views the majority of Canadians. It's as sources of labor. It's hard to think about the nature of work without thinking about how clarifying the pandemic was and how it changed some aspects without changing others.
Do you think our season on labor would have been different if we were making it before the pandemic?
You know, I think there were two different kind of outcomes from the pandemic, one for white-collar workers and one for blue-collar workers. White-collar workers have had some concessions made, right? I think working from home is a pretty major thing that's not going away, that is clearly a kind of pro-worker approach in a lot of ways that a lot of white-collar workers get now. Of course, blue-collar workers never had that option during the pandemic and certainly still don't have that option today. But in my experience, talking to even friends and family members alongside a lot of the people that you're going to hear from in our upcoming season on Commons, the sentiment that I get is like they really do feel that exploitation a little bit more, whether they're white collar or blue collar. They really see themselves as like, oh, I'm a little bit of a cog in the machine, especially for millennials like us. And I'm speaking about Jordan and I. I know, Noor, you are not a millennial.
Yeah, please don't loop me into that. Keep me out.
I know. I would never dare put that kind of offensive label on you. But for millennials like Jordan and I, we entered a job market that at the same time we were supposed to be kind of idealistic, right? We were supposed to kind of reach for professions, for workplaces that we thought would, you know, help shape the world. There was a lot of kind of optimism about this stuff. But at the same time, we entered into the workforce in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And, you know, that kind of like disjuncture has never really, I think, fully been resolved in millennials. And the pandemic just kind of did that one more time, right?
Yeah. And I feel like I can like look back on like literally from the time that I graduated to now, just like the timeline is just pockmarked by layoffs or, you know, pockmarked by, and I'm speaking like mostly to like the journalism industry, the pivot to video era. You know, there's just era after era that I can look at that have been demoralizing and I think made it difficult to be optimistic or idealistic. You know, you start to think more about the value of your life outside of work. And I think maybe we're seeing that attitude a bit more these days as people do have that sort of self-awareness of themselves as a worker and value like what I get to do outside much more. And that's where you kind of see resistance kind of growing.
It's true. And I think with that has come a slight resurgence in the union movement. You know, even when I was coming out of university or in university, amongst young people, I think unions kind of had a bad rap overall. And you can argue that that is a lot of their own fault or the unions were not effective or if it was ideological. It was definitely something that I noticed that people view them more positively. I mean, here, this is now a unionized workplace.
Well, I'll say, like, you know, my dad is like a, you know, it's a blue collar worker. He was a UPS driver. Probably the most excited he was hearing about something that happened to me at work was when I called him and told him we unionized.
You know, that's so interesting.
Because he understands the value of that, though, right? Like, you know, he had a strong union at UPS that I guess, like, throughout the years provided some benefit to him. And he was excited to hear that I would have something like that.
I mean, my dad, same thing. He was a custodian at a school board. I was a member of CUPE. I don't know if he particularly felt pride in the union or not, but he knew that it helped put food on the table.
Oh, yeah. It was begrudging, for sure. But, like, for all of the complaints I heard from my dad about his union over the years, he was still excited that I was a part of one.
But yeah, I think that is another one of the changes that came through the pandemic. People look at unions or broader labor organizing in a kind of different light. And I think more and more people, again, are just seeing themselves as kind of workers first. And that is a central part of their identity. I don't think it's everybody, but it is definitely a bigger number of people than from before.
Well, I think there's like a lot of really strong labor reporting in Canada there's not a ton of labor reporters. When you think about labor reporting, what's your approach to it like? And also, what's the landscape of labor reporting been like in Canada in recent years?
You know, the emphasis was very much, and still is today, on business reporting. You know, I basically self-identify as a business journalist. I think that's how a lot of my approach has been. That's how I come up with a lot of the stories that I do. But when you're approaching things from a kind of business angle, I mean, even the language that you use is totally different, right? A business reporter will talk about, like, downsizing, right? Downsizing is such a jargony euphemism for layoffs or people getting fired. Right? But in business reporting, we often kind of like de-emphasize the role of like the worker and such incentives to ask questions like, you know, is this quarter going to be more profitable? What do your earnings look like? All of the stuff you're looking at is very different than if you're a labor reporter, you're going to be approaching things like, what are the working conditions like? Are workers being treated fairly? What kind of role are they contributing to the success of the company or the enterprise? You know, overall, I think like as a culture, we have almost devalued like work and workers. It's ironic because we kind of have this hustle culture mentality.
Yeah, but that's never about working or workers. It's always about becoming the entity, you know, becoming the business. I feel like that's the goal, right? Like that's the goal of hustle culture is not to like be a laborer. It's to be an employer.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's kind of seen as a failure if you just want to be a worker almost. Like, I don't want to be a manager. I don't want to own a thing. Like, these are not the things that I aspire to. I saw this tweet online that was basically like, there are only three jobs left, three types of jobs. Job number one, you make $250,000 doing project management at Evil Corp, right? Job number two, it's like all the jobs you heard of as a kid that are normal, librarian or journalist or teacher or nurse, but they've been so squeezed and you make $50,000 a year and you kind of hate your life. And then third one is basically just like delivery on Uber and being paid less than minimum wage, and it's not even really a job.
Yeah, so gig work.
And it feels like we've just kind of fallen into like those three buckets. And it's ironic to me that the jobs that we kind of are taught as children to respect
and aspire to
make very little money. People are completely feeling stressed out. People leave that there's kind of like labor crises.
And they're often punched down on in a way that I feel like I never saw growing up, but I do see a lot now. Like, you know, the teachers are whiners. The nurses are whiners. But I do find that, like, now the conversation around a lot of those jobs is less kind.
It's true. But and to bring it back to the kind of idea of, like, labor reporting, I think the fact that the labor reporter has disappeared as, like, an entity in newspapers, while with a handful of very notable exceptions, really speaks to how much, like, the union movement has declined, how much the kind of corporate owners of a lot of these businesses, what their priorities are. You know, Philip Crawley was the publisher of the Globe and Mail for a long time, but he famously said that the Globe and Mail is for people who make $100,000 or more. And the Globe does some pretty phenomenal labor reporting, despite that. But I think it just speaks to the kind of broader attitude and why every single paper has a business section. There's no labor section of a paper anymore. And you know what? 75 years ago, there were a ton of labor reporters. There was a lot of emphasis on this, and that has declined. Now, there is a new generation of journalists trying to do that work. Many of them are doing a fantastic job. You'll be hearing from some of them in our season as well. But yeah, things have changed pretty dramatically.
When you think about what this series might contribute to the overall kind of labor conversation in Canada, like one thing I think that we do is we don't just talk about kind of like what's going on right now. We also talk about what's happened in the past. So, Noor, what should people expect from this season?
To hear from a lot of workers, I think that one thing that was really important to me in this season was centering the experiences of the people that are, you know, most impacted by economic policy, by labor markets and all that supply demand nonsense that I still can't wrap my head around. Talking to the people who are at the forefront of those stories, whether it be nurses, fishermen, migrant farm workers, you'll hear from the people at the heart of the stories. And that's something I'm looking forward to.
Archie?
I think our listeners can expect some pretty fascinating and dramatic stories. I mean, a lot of the stories that we're covering take place in some of the most interesting places you can think of. It's literally drama on the high seas, in emergency rooms, like these giant kind of organizing drives. I mean, this is the stuff of movies. And so that's what I'm really excited for our audience to get into and get a chance to hear, that these really dramatic, important stories. So there's a lot of ground to cover, and we will have 17 whole episodes on this stuff that I think people are just going to find compelling, and they're going to find the folks that we talk to utterly fascinating.
Commons will be busy making this season, so you can now return to your regularly scheduled programming.
Does that mean we can unlock Jesse from the closet that we've been holding him in?
No.
We can leave
no,
him in there a little bit
longer. Absolutely not. Yes.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. This episode was put together by the Commons team, Arshi Mann, Jordan Cornish, and Noor Azria. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicione. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our production coordinator is Andre Prou. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Jen Wong, journalist, author. Hello.
Hi.
Today on the show, Jan, from Winnipeg to Wuhan, we've got spies. And what does Brian Mulroney have to do to be regarded as the greatest Canadian Prime Minister in history? I think we just found out. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. Jan, I'm going to take you back in time some years now. Do you remember this story about those two scientists in Winnipeg?
Very vaguely.
Good morning.
Dr. Zhango Chu has been recognized by the Governor General's Innovation Awards. She and the team at the National Microbiology Lab have been praised for developing an Ebola vaccine. But just over a week ago, Chu, her husband, and her students from China were evicted from Canada's only Level 4 lab, their security access revoked.
We don't know why Drs. Chu and Cheng were fired. We don't know how a scientist from the People's Liberation Army gained access to the Winnipeg lab.
When it comes to questions about whether the two former federal scientists were spying for China,
I'm not aware of what you mentioned.
Today, a Chinese official deflected.
There's no reason for Ottawa to be secretive about this. We already know that they've sent Ebola virus to China and that they're working with the Chinese military scientists. This is known. What else are they hiding?
This was all very murky back when the news broke. And to run through the bare bones of it, you have this couple who had been working at the Canadian National Microbiology Laboratory in Winnipeg since 2003. The superstar of this couple, they're a married couple, was Dr. Chu, who won the 2018 Canadian Governor General's Innovation Award for an Ebola drug. This all played out before the coronavirus pandemic. In August 2020, the security clearances were suspended. They were fired in 2021. It became a political issue. The Conservatives seized upon it. You know, Trudeau is hiding. And it became also fodder for conspiracy sites because there were, like, of course, everyone was very curious about virology and Chinese research into weapons and foreign interference. So Justin Ling, writing about this a couple of years ago in Maclean's, about how this got politicized, and he wrote, you know, conservative members of parliament, this is a quote, have further called Chu's removal an odd coincidence in light of the COVID-19 outbreak, winking to the theory that the virus originated in the Wuhan lab and accusing the Trudeau government of a quote-unquote cover-up and quote-unquote corruption in the case. But the accusation smacked of a conclusion in search of evidence. So that's what Ling wrote. And he said, you know, whatever the explanation, it's high time for Ottawa and the RCMP to clarify what exactly Chu is alleged to have done. And again, he was putting that question to Ottawa and the RCMP 2 years ago. Well, Jan, we finally have some of those answers.
Finally.
They went through this long bureaucratic process of what information to share because, you know, all kinds of national secrets had to be protected. And when they finally dumped the documents, like, they're very lightly redacted. And Steve Chase at the Globe and Mail recently appeared on their podcast.